Good morning.
Good morning.
Wow, that was great. I heard more than just Brian. Welcome to our opening convocation. We welcome our new students, first years and transfers, and we hope that you're finding your way around and beginning to make connections. Welcome back to our returning students. I trust that you had a great summer break and that you're ready to engage learning once again. I want to welcome our new faculty and staff. We had an amazing faculty-staff conference this fall, and now you will see how this campus comes alive when the students return. And finally, welcome to our returning faculty and staff. May the energy, the excitement, and the enthusiasm of our newest members infect us too. Our opening convocation is a time to formally begin the year. But this year is different in that it is our 90th year as an academic institution. May this be the year in which we engage learning together, a year in which we mark our past by celebrating our 90th anniversary, but also begin to map our future toward our centennial, a year in which we unleash the potential of this university, its students, its faculty, and its staff. A year for sacred conversations. A year like no other. I'm glad to be here this year, and I hope you are too. Please stand now for the invocation as we invite God's presence. Come, Holy Spirit. Come as holy fire and burn in our hearts. Come as holy wind and cleanse us. Come as holy light and lead us to wisdom. Come as holy truth and dispel our ignorance. Come as holy power and overcome our weakness. Come as holy life and dwell in us. Come, Holy Spirit, come. Amen.
Ecclesiastes 7:23-25. All this I tested by wisdom, and I said, I am determined to be wise. But this was beyond me. Whatever wisdom may be, it is far off and profound. Who can discover it?
So I turned my mind to understand, to investigate and search out wisdom and the scheme of things, and to understand the stupidity of wickedness and the madness of folly.
Good morning. We are the SGA co-presidents. I'm Lindsay, and this is Sarah. And we just wanted to say that we're excited to be back this year, and it's good to see all the new faces and the old ones. And we're excited about all the opportunities this year has. Right now, we're going to introduce our president. Dr. Lauren E. Swartzentruber became the 8th president of Eastern Mennonite University on January 1st, 2004. And just last spring, he was reappointed to another 4-year term as EMU's president. Dr. Swartzentruber came to EMU from Heston College, where he served as president since 1994. Before that, he was associate executive secretary of the former Mennonite Board of Education in Elkhart, Indiana, for 10 years. A native of Kelowna, Iowa, Lauren graduated from EMU in 1976 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in Liberal Arts and earned a Master of Divinity degree from Eastern Mennonite Seminary in 1979. He completed a Doctor of Ministry degree at Northern Baptist Theological Seminary in 2000. His thesis focused on increasing Mennonite parental involvement in the college choice.
After graduating from EMU, Lauren was an Associate Director of Admissions and part-time Associate Campus Pastor at his alma mater. He was ordained to the Christian ministry in 1975 at Lower Deer Creek Mennonite Church near Kelowna, Iowa, and was pastor at Salford Mennonite Church in Harleysville, Pennsylvania from 1978 to 1983. Dr. Swartzentruber is a member of Parkview Mennonite Church here in Harrisonburg and serves on the advisory board of Harrisonburg Downtown Renaissance, a local community organization that works for the restoration and preservation of the downtown area. And in his spare time, he enjoys playing golf. Lauren is married to Pat Swartzentruber, a native of Wellman, Iowa. She works full-time as a volunteer for Eastern Mennonite University and serves on several church-wide boards. The couple has 4 adult children, 3 of whom are EMU alum. Please help us in welcoming Dr. Lauren E. Schwarzendruber.
Thank you and welcome to all of you. As Dr. Morris has already suggested, this fall, on October 15, EMU will celebrate its 90th birthday. As is true for most schools born in 1917, our beginnings were rather inauspicious. The time from conception to birth is usually 9 months, but in the case of EMU, it was more than a decade. It took that many years to gather the resources, the money, the personnel, and the facilities for the dream to become a reality. The tuition for that first year, 19, 17, and 18, was a whopping $30. $15 per term. Room and board was actually more expensive than tuition. The students paid a total of $149 for tuition, room, and board for the year. And I don't know what the student wages were that first year, but we're told that several years later, about 1922, that the students were paid for campus jobs at the rate of about 22.5 cents an hour. Apparently, it didn't take too long to get things ready for that first class of students. The first president, J.B. Smith, didn't even move to Harrisonburg with his family until October 9, less than a week before the first day of classes. His appointment as president had only been announced 3 weeks earlier. Now, here's an interesting story from Dr. Hubert Pellman's History of EMU. When President Smith, actually they called him the principal in those days, arrived in town, he discovered that several students were already here and had been waiting for 2 weeks to start classes. Now, I can hardly wait for that day. When students are so eager to start classes that they arrive 2 weeks before the first day, I'd love it, although I do sort of wonder where they might camp out. But I think it'd be a great news article for the Daily News Record next fall. EMU president returns early from vacation to deal with 100 students camped out at 1919 Park Road demanding that classes begin. According to Pellman's research, President Smith set up a table the morning after he arrived, lined up 6 students in chairs, and proceeded to register them for classes. There were 4 faculty members, in addition to Smith, who taught the Bible and religion classes, 3 men and 1 woman. Now, President Smith had greater powers of concentration than I do, although I think we might have both shared a commonly weird sense of humor. He was sitting across the table from a guy by the name of Souter, and as they were studying, he kept wiping from the back of his bald head spots where water was dripping on his head, but he just kept wiping it off the bald spot, and it was a leaking water pipe, had been dripping on him for several minutes. Finally, he figured out what was happening. He jumped up and he said to the other guy, "Souter, if I want a shower, I'd like a little more seclusion." To be sure, the EMU of 2007 is very different than the Eastern Mennonite School of 1917. We've survived the Great Depression, 2 world wars, many other challenges, both national and international. And as I read the list of the names of those first 6 students, I think there were no international students with us in 1917, and there certainly was no cross-cultural requirement. Although I suppose one might say that coming to Virginia from Michigan and Ohio might have qualified, as some of those students did. That first class of 6 students comprised 4 women and 2 men, an even greater percentage of women than EMU now has in the undergraduate division. Although I'd have to say, we're often surprised. People are surprised when they find out that we're about 60-40 ratio undergrad here, women to men, but that's actually the national average. On the other hand, some core elements are similar. Smith, in his role as a Bible teacher, was interested in both faith development and academic scholarship. In fact, one of his requirements in an entry-level Bible class was to have all of the students memorize 1,000 Bible verses. those that he selected as, quote, the 1,000 best verses of the Bible. It'd be very interesting to know which ones those were. Would probably say a lot about the theology of the day. Even in those days, however, he promoted more than an elementary knowledge of the Bible. He put it this way: it is highly important that the church has at least a few scholars who are able to go to the sources of history and revelation and speak with authority from the viewpoint of unmistakable evidence and indisputable facts. Now, I would love to have been in on some of those arguments about what was unmistakable evidence and indisputable facts, because I would dare say they had arguments about that. But nevertheless, his interest was in both faith development and academic understandings of the scriptures. The text from Ecclesiastes that was read for us a few minutes ago refers, as does much of the entire book, to the search for wisdom. The writer infers that wisdom is something, quote, far off, that is difficult to discover. So I turned my mind to understand, to investigate and to search out wisdom and the scheme of things. Now, this next phrase might be particularly apropos to us as we live together. And to understand the stupidity of wickedness and the madness of folly. But that's an interesting phrase. But that we understand that wisdom is something that we have to search for. A few verses later, adding one thing to another to discover the scheme of things. Wisdom is not something that just hits us like a bolt of lightning, at least not normally. Of course, there are those aha moments that happen. But most of the time, it comes and develops over time. We generally think of wisdom as pertaining primarily to the head. Occasionally, we confuse the ideas of knowledge and wisdom. Yet I think all of us know that wisdom is more than just the compilation of facts and knowledge. A few years ago, I saw a little 3-year-old kid on TV, and his parents were able to show him the pictures of all of the former and living U.S. presidents. And this little 3-year-old kid could, by looking at the picture, identify every one of those U.S. presidents by name. He could hardly understand how he pronounced their names, but he knew them by sight. So demonstrated that even at a very young age, the human mind can hold a great deal of knowledge. Of course, we know that just from observing how language skills are developed. But no one should assume that the little fellow possessed wisdom just because he had that knowledge. On the other end of the continuum, I've met a few older folks who do not appear to be wise, even though they've had a great deal of life experience. A number of years ago, I was chatting with a student at the end of the summer, and he was preparing to return back to Goshen College, and I asked him if he was eager to go back, and he said yes, because I was on a house painting crew all summer, and one day I asked the guy on the crew, who was also from our congregation, what he thinks about all day as he's painting houses. He thought a while, and then he said, you know, I don't think I think about anything. And the college student told me, that's when I knew I had to go back to school. Not because he was denigrating the profession of painting houses, but what he was saying is, if I paint houses for a lifetime, that's fine, but I'd like to be thinking about something while I'm doing it. Wisdom is certainly not synonymous with years of age, but it is extremely difficult to obtain without life experience, and age has something to do with that. The question then is, how do we grow in wisdom? And what happens at EMU that helps to make us wiser persons? We know several things from national research. Fully one half of what a student learns in the undergraduate world, and I suspect this may be true for graduate studies as well, but fully one half of what a student learns happens outside the formal classroom. Now, please understand, that does not mean that faculty members are unimportant. In fact, one of the distinct advantages of a place like EMU is that you can learn from the faculty member both in and outside of the classroom, and there are multiple opportunities to interact outside the formal setting. James O. Friedman, who later served as president of University of Iowa and Dartmouth College, in his book, Finding the Words, writing about his undergraduate days at Harvard University. The fact that we never saw the president, rarely could schedule a meeting with a professor, sat in many classes of several hundred students, and could not find knowledgeable teachers to write letters of recommendation seemed merely a necessary aspect of the way in which a great university operated. I think that's a sad commentary on much of higher education. So it should be obvious, I suppose, that we do believe that wisdom can be obtained by reading many books, not simply by reading them, but by engaging their content through reflection and discussion. We do expect our students and graduates to demonstrate the capacity for critical thinking, and in a liberal arts setting like EMU, we celebrate various approaches to knowledge and wisdom through music and art and the study of foreign languages, as well as history and science and religion. We ask a lot of questions. And sometimes it is more important to frame the question correctly than it is to arrive at the final answer. And we've all heard that illustration, the little quip of the danger of asking the wrong question, such as, have you stopped beating your spouse yet? There is no right answer to that question, but the problem is it's the wrong question. Well, unfortunately, in some cases, it's the right question, but it's not the framing. It's not the right way to frame the question because it doesn't yield an answer that's helpful. Douglas and Rhonda Husted Jacobson, in their book on scholarship and Christian faith, note that in linking faith and learning, personal factors often play as important a role as logical argument. When that happens, scholarship becomes a matter of living the questions as much as it is a search for definitive answers. Since 1917, during each of the past 89 years, this campus has been a place for millions of sacred conversations. In some ways, for me, that's the essence of a liberal arts education in the context of a faith-based university. Sometimes it is the conversations between generations, in which those with more life experience converse with those who have less life experience. One way we will work at this during the coming year is through a chapel series called I Believe, in which members of the campus community will share from their life experience, followed by opportunities for response and dialogue. But genuine conversations are two-way, and meaningful conversations are based on mutual respect and trust. And they can happen in the classroom, in the faculty members' offices, with supervisors in work-study jobs, informally over coffee, and in many other settings. And they happen during the late night bull sessions in the residence halls or with roommates who share an apartment. And like every year since 1917, this year we will have sacred conversations about many topics. The role of faith in our lives and vocations. What does it mean to be a university in the Christian tradition that also invites dialogue with those of other faith traditions? How do we in the Christian tradition as followers of Jesus live as peacemakers in a violent world? Is peacemaking simply a political effort based on humanitarian values, which would certainly be a good thing in our world, or is the effort to build on a deeper and stronger foundation? And how do we engage the world in major world issues such as poverty, hunger, HIV/AIDS, global warming? Some of those are really big questions that require ongoing attention and are not necessarily unique to EMU. In October, I've been invited to represent this institution in a meeting with the General Secretary of the United Nations. Interestingly, it's been called by and coordinated by the National Association of Evangelicals because it is a group of people who often would not be thought of as having paid attention to some of these larger issues. But their point in calling the meeting with the General Secretary is to bring global leaders together from the North and the South to talk about these issues in the context of faith, and to call people of faith to address them. As I look ahead, I see some particular conversations on this campus that fit well within those larger questions. Let me note just a few, and I'm going to note a few that would be of particular interest to students. There are other and additional conversations that will involve mostly faculty and staff. One, the proposal to develop a center for for the study of Abrahamic faith traditions. And we are uniquely situated as a campus because of the Center for Justice and Peace Building, the seminary, the undergraduate Bible and Religion Department, and others, all of whom have worldwide international experience and have interacted with people of other faiths in those dialogues. And we are uniquely situated, I think, to continue that conversation. Secondly, the design of a new science facility that is environmentally friendly. Thirdly, sustainability in many facets of campus life, such as building green, use of food, transportation, etc. And finally, a task force that will involve students that will begin its work this fall to develop recommendations for residential housing improvements, and that means thinking green, and it also means how do we do residential housing that promotes the concept of living and learning in community. Let me close with two observations. Observations about behaviors which I believe minimize the opportunity to gain wisdom through sacred conversations. One is that we as a wired generation, that's all of us, but it's more applicable, I suppose, to the younger generation. This wired generation is tempted to substitute electronic interaction for meaningful personal dialogue. I think it's almost, maybe I should even say virtually, impossible to have sacred conversations through Facebook, MySpace, and text messaging. Not that those are inappropriate, but they are only good for certain ways of communicating, not about the deep, big issues that we ought to be talking about. We need face-to-face dialogue. Settings like this, although then we need another chair pulled up here so that people talk to each other face-to-face. Secondly, and this is related to the first observation, I invite all of us to sink our roots deep into this community at EMU for the months and years that we are here. And by definition, that means reducing the amount of time interacting with those not intimately involved in your academic world. Now, let me be very clear. I don't mean things like community learning. I'm not talking about being physically tied to this campus and learning only by interacting here. But what I do mean is that I think we have to reduce the connections that we have back home sometimes to our family members or to other people who aren't involved in the academic pursuit here. It's just physically and psychologically impossible to maintain daily or tougher yet several times a day in-depth contact with your family members back home or your former school friends scattered all over the world and give adequate attention to your academic requirements, spiritual life, physical well-being, which includes things like adequate sleep and physical exercise, social interactions, and conversations on campus. Something has to give. And I submit it is much more important and healthy to give primary attention to your present environment. And that goes for all of us, not just students, but faculty and staff as well. I pray that God will be present among us this year as we engage in daily sacred conversations, and may we all grow in wisdom. Thank you.